It's Tuesday, September 13th, and who said Brits aren't sentimental? We start here. The UK pays homage to Queen Elizabeth as her coffin makes its way to its final resting place.
Some of these towns only have a few hundred people in them, yet thousands of people showed up.
What the crush of crowds are telling us about a mournful nation. The government might not track which guns you've purchased, but could a credit card company?
They could flag that to authorities and, you know, potentially try to get ahead of something, you know, horrific happening.
Pressure on banks has led to a significant development. And they say a famine's not on the way, it's already arrived.
Her husband died on the way to try to come to this camp?
Yes. Inside the disaster unfolding in Somalia and why the next few weeks could be even worse. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Brad Milkey. You know the phrase, keep calm and carry on? You've probably seen it on a poster somewhere. That phrase was originally seen on posters during World War II in Britain, but those posters weren't really circulated that much. In fact, the phrase wasn't widely used until a copy of those posters was found just 20 years ago, which I didn't know. I'd assumed it was always just said, because it seems so perfectly British, right? Specifically, it seems to embody everything about the Britain that Queen Elizabeth II ruled over. Keep calm and carry on. It was as if she was practicing that slogan every day of her reign.
We should take comfort that while we may have more still to endure, better days will return.
Over the last few days, as the body of the fallen queen toured the Scottish countryside, it became clear this would not be business as usual. There is no stiff upper lip here. People have swarmed towards her coffin, often unable to hold back their tears. And today, that coffin will be on its way to London. ABC's foreign correspondent Maggie Rooley actually has a unique perspective here because she was at Balmoral the day Elizabeth died. Since then, wherever the fallen queen has gone, Maggie has followed. She's in Edinburgh right now. Maggie, what's fascinating is that if the Queen hadn't died in Scotland, we likely wouldn't have seen so many of these extraordinary scenes. So what have we missed?
Yeah, exactly, Brad. That's what's so amazing about all of this. You know, they call it Operation Unicorn. That's what we've been seeing unfold, this whole procession of the Queen's coffin traveling from her beloved Balmoral down to Edinburgh. And when we talk to Scottish people on the ground, I'm shocked by how much it's meant to them.
I'm very sad about this.
I'll never see another
queen like her. Never.
So many of them have told me that it almost feels as if this whole thing was meant to be. Like, that the queen made this decision. She chose to pass away in Scotland just so that this would happen, just so that she would have one final chance to say goodbye to the Scottish people, give the Scottish people one last chance to be close to her again.
For people around here in Deeside, that they were just a neighbour in the community, you know, they were just part of the wider kind of community family.
And you mentioned that emotion, Brad. I mean, we cannot stress this point enough. The weight of the moment is not lost on anyone. We have gone along the entire route with Queen Elizabeth in this motorcade, starting in Balmoral, making our way down to Edinburgh, and along the entire route, thousands of people. And Brad, what's so amazing about this is, you know, when she made that trip down from Balmoral, she was snaking through backcountry roads, through small Scottish towns. It took 6 hours. Some of these towns only have a few hundred people in them, yet thousands of people showed up.
It's very sad. It's very emotional. And just to feel that amongst everybody who's here and to hear the journeys that some of the people who have made to be here, I think is really special.
I mean, that's an incredible statement to what Queen Elizabeth meant to the Scottish people. And when she drove past, Brad, you know, I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but everyone just fell silent. Thousands of people, a huge crowd, and you could hear a pin drop. I think everyone really wanted to just spend this moment being together with their queen. As one woman put it, she said, you know, I wanted to be here to be near my queen one final time, to feel her spirit one final time.
And so we gather to bid Scotland's farewell to our late monarch.
She's lying in state here for 24 hours in Edinburgh. This is really a chance for all the Scottish people to come and have that final moment with their queen. And authorities are saying they're getting larger numbers than they expected. Last we checked, it was more than a mile long in the line, tens of thousands of people waiting, many of them getting there at the crack of dawn, waiting through the night, Brad. This is a 24/7 operation. And this is just sort of a glimpse of what we're expecting to happen in London, because after those 24 hours wrap up later today, the queen's coffin is going to board a Royal Air Force airplane. They're flying the Queen down to London, where then tomorrow there'll be a similar procession like we saw in Edinburgh through the streets of London, bringing her to once again lie in state, this time for 4 days in London. Overnight, 4 days, 24 hours a day. The police in London have already said people should expect to wait in line for up to 20 hours.
And Maggie, like, I'm thinking now, you're an American who's now lived in the UK for several years at this point. What has it been like to talk to people, I guess, around the country about their queen?
Yeah, Brad, it's been so interesting. And I think as an American, it's very challenging to totally understand and grasp what the queen, what the monarchy means to a nation. I think you always feel a little bit like an outsider when you haven't grown up with the monarchy.
The queen means so much to everyone. I'm born in the UK, and so I've only known the queen all my life. And just her sense of duty and everything is just demands my respect.
And right just now, when I talk to British people, for many of them, you know, they're grieving the loss of this woman that's been a constant, a woman and many of them thought of kind of as their grandmother. But there's also this sense of losing some of their national identity and questioning where it's going to come from next.
This is just so different to be seeing, you know, the Queen's head on our currency for so many years and then for it to be replaced with King Charles.
With this potential struggle in this new transition and what it means for themselves personally as well as for the country.
Yeah, and I think the rawness of the reactions here, like you said, have really kind of shaped what we know about how emotionally connected a large part of this population was with their queen. Maggie Rooley there in Scotland. Thank you.
Thanks, Brad.
Next up on Start Here, back in the U.S., a distinctly American problem with perhaps a very American next step. We're back in a bit. With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November, and while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Later today, the new Consumer Price Index will be unveiled, telling us just how much more expensive some items have become. But another piece of interesting financial news happened this weekend, and it reminds you that even as Americans press lawmakers to end legislative deadlocks, sometimes it's pressure campaigns on private companies that can push the ball even further.
Visa announcing today they will begin categorizing sales at gun shops separately.
That seems to be what's happening in the world of gun purchases right now. ABC's Elizabeth Schulze covers the economy. You probably haven't heard her for the last few months because she's been off raising a child. Elizabeth Schulze, welcome back. You had a baby in this economy.
I had a baby. He is so excited about this CPI report today, Brad. All about the inflation data. Cannot wait to dig into it, just like me.
Hey, so help me understand this story then, because on the surface, this is like a super wonky story. You got this credit card company, Visa, recategorizing gun sales. But both sides of the gun debate says this is actually a really huge development. Why?
Yeah, absolutely, Brad. You know, what this is a big win for activists who were really pushing credit card companies like Visa to play a more active role in trying to curb what are seen as suspicious gun sales. So basically what we're talking about here, when you go to a purchase and you go to a store, when you buy something with your credit card, the purchase from that store falls under what's called a merchant code. So if you go buy groceries at Whole Foods, the retailer Whole Foods, that has a groceries merchant code. And like there's merchant codes for like every kind of retailer, nail salons, hair salons, shoe shine parlors, all sorts of these merchant codes. But there hadn't been a merchant code for gun retailers. So if you went and bought a gun with your credit card or debit card from a gun store, that purchase actually fell under a sporting goods merchant code or even a general merchandise code. Obviously, buying like a camping tent or a tennis ball, that is very different than buying a gun.
Whether you're getting a car repair, whether or not you attend a nail salon, every business tracks credit card transactions in this nation. And so I don't think it would be difficult to create a unique merchant code that reports a purchase for a gun.
So there had been this push from activists, even from some banks. This union-owned bank called Amalgamated Bank was kind of behind this push too, to basically create this merchant code for gun sales that would clearly label these sales as credit card transactions as guns. And what that would do is then make it easier to track suspicious activity related to gun sales kind of falling under a pattern.
Yeah, I was trying to understand, why would that matter to recategorize them? Like, what difference would that make?
Right. So what this would allow the credit card companies to do is to note patterns or changes in behavior that then they could flag to authorities to potentially investigate those sales. So so the example here that's used, credit card companies already do this for other financial crimes like fraud or embezzlement or human trafficking. So think of this like, if someone is using credit card transactions frequently along the same route of the highway in high dollar amounts, spending those monies at motels, gas stations, and fast food restaurants repeatedly, you know, in a pattern, that could be a signal of human trafficking.
Oh.
And what the credit card companies do regularly already is flag that suspicious activity to authorities who could then possibly investigate if there is a crime related to human trafficking there.
Establishing these category codes on gun and ammunition purchases is a basic and common sense step that would help prevent a future mass shooting or reduce the risk of gun trafficking.
So if there's a pattern where a lot of guns are being purchased at once, and we have seen this in previous mass shootings where there are high dollar amounts of gun sales just within days of a shooting happening, the credit card company could now have this merchant code where they see that those sales are happening, and
right,
they could flag that to authorities and, you know, potentially try to get ahead of something, you know, horrific happening.
Right. I remember the Pulse nightclub shooter bought like $20,000 of guns on his credit card in the days
right
before the attack. I mean, clearly this is what gun activists want to happen, Elizabeth. It still sounds like it's unclear who would be doing that reporting, right? Because you got credit cards, you got banks. Which of them are willing to do this? Which of them want to do that? But I guess the fact that you can categorize these purchases, wouldn't that worry gun rights groups that have always been nervous about this idea of a national registry of guns that theoretically, they say, would lay the groundwork for having the government taking guns away? Is that a concern?
Of course. Anytime you hear movement about how to track your purchases, whether it's from authorities or companies themselves, there's going to be pushback from people.
They've not defined what suspicious activity is. Is suspicious 2 guns? Is it 3 guns? Is it 5 guns? Is it 5,000?
I think one really important thing to understand here, these codes will show where guns were bought, but not what's purchased.
Mm.
So, you know, you don't necessarily know how many guns someone bought. You don't necessarily know what type, but you would see that there is a pattern emerging.
Well, and so what happens next? Because MasterCard and Amex had already said that they do plan to make this change in the purchase code. Visa's joining suit. It almost seems like this is as much of a story about gun violence as it is about a story of political campaigns being waged towards corporations.
No doubt, Brad. We have seen growing pressure on corporate America on a lot of political issues, politically charged issues, and guns are one of them. This is an attempt by activists to say corporate America needs to do more when it comes to their role in potentially stopping or having any role when it comes to gun sales. At the end of the day, a lot of guns are purchased with credit cards. So there is going to be pressure not just on the credit card companies, but potentially on the banks that are processing those credit card payments, that are processing bank accounts. You know, this is the initial standard being set, the creation of this code. There could still be more to be done when it comes to corporate America and what role they have to play in whether it's gun sales or the broader gun control debate, Brad.
Yeah, we've seen these kind of corporate efforts in some other political arenas now, the gun debate. Elizabeth Schulze, great to have you back. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Recently, the United Nations gave a dire warning, saying unless something drastic happens, the country of Somalia is about to be hit with a full-fledged famine, meaning there's so little to eat in a country that vast populations simply begin starving to death.
With ever-escalating needs and a fifth failed rainy season projected, a further scale-up of humanitarian assistance is critical.
If you're trying to picture it on a map, Somalia sits on the eastern tip of Africa, sticks out into the Indian Ocean, just below the Arabian Peninsula. It's got a huge coastline, and while it's been prone to drought before, they've never seen anything like this. So, ABC's Matt Gutman, who's been reporting on food shortages in Africa for years now, packed his bags and went to Somalia to find out how a country of 15 million people could be on the brink of mass starvation. He joins us now. Matt, where exactly are you?
We're in a town called Baidoa, which is southwest Somalia, about 150 miles from Mogadishu. And this is the epicenter of the crisis, Brad.
Behind me is one of the 70 encampments in Baidoa, which used to be a small town. It is now one of the fastest growing cities in Africa.
There are 600,000 people who fled their homes trying to find some humanitarian assistance here.
So it sounds like from both what the UN is saying and what it sounds like people are telling you on the ground that a famine is either on the way or it's already arrived. Which is it?
Well, it's a really good question. So famine is a technical and political declaration, and the country of Somalia is not yet ready to declare that.
When was the last time they ate meat?
Here in Baidoa and across the country, we are far to the north of here, about 500 plus miles, and elsewhere, we've seen hundreds and hundreds of dead livestock. There are 3.5 million that are dead.
I don't remember, he said, because if you look the goats we have, they have 2 weeks. There's no meat to eat, so not even you might get sick.
Here in Baidoa, we saw a nutrition center run by Save the Children. And there were hundreds of mothers outside with their children whose arms are as thick as my finger.
What is she trying to say? She pointed out her child.
There was a mother there. Her name was Garen Hassan. She tugged at my shirt to try to get me to pay attention to her. And I started talking to her.
Why does she think that her baby is sick? What leads her to the sides?
Diarrhea and vomiting. She became weak.
How old is she?
Her daughter, 18 months old, was sick. And weighs less than 11 pounds. That's less than half of what a child her age should weigh.
She's so incredibly thin. What's the name of her baby?
Malaika.
Malaika.
Malaika, yeah.
But her mother said she can't take her because she has all these other children to look after because her husband died on the way to Baidoa.
Her husband died on the way to try to come to this camp?
Yes, because the little water they had, he gave to her and the baby. So he died because of that.
I'm so sorry.
They buried him by the side of the road, so she is looking after the rest of her family.
So she's saying that she doesn't want to go to the stabilization center because she has six children here?
Yeah.
So she's just going to go? What about the baby?
So we went and checked on her again yesterday, and health workers with Save the Children said that those children simply have to go to the hospital right now or they could die. So she was rushed in a van to what's called the stabilization center, and her kids were given treatment. Hi.
How are you?
Good.
Hi. Yeah.
Hi, da.
She feels better?
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah. I'm eating. I'm happy.
Is she eating? Yeah.
So at that nutrition center, a Save the Children official said, if this is not famine, what is? basically saying that, you know, it's been politics for the lack of a declaration. The UN is saying that right now there are over 300,000 people in the highest level of crisis imaginable, basically starving to death. There are over 500,000 children right now who are at risk of dying. Basically, their bodies have broken down. They are too sick to eat, even too weak to cry. 500,000. And if they don't get treatment, it is very possible that up to 250,000 of those children could die.
As far as causes, is this just not enough water, not enough farming? How does this get this bad?
To use a cliche, it is a perfect storm of terrible things.
Ambassador, can you explain just some of the factors that are conspiring to make this a possibly very deadly situation here?
So on the one hand, you have the worst drought on record in Somalia.
You have the Russian attack on Ukraine, which has led to very high grain prices, high fertilizer prices, high fuel prices. All of that plays into the food security situation.
You have humanitarian groups who are just so cash-strapped right now because donor attention has been elsewhere. And you have insecurity.
The part of the country where the drought began and is most severe is also the part of the country that has, for the longest time, been under al-Shabaab occupation.
Every time we go anywhere, we have multiple armored vehicles. We have guys with AK-47s, front and back, about 12 of them, everywhere we go. And that is not just here, but across the country.
I was discussing with a woman head of household. Despite the drought, they were able to raise enough crops, have enough harvest to keep their family alive for a year. They are in al-Shabaab-controlled territory. Al-Shabaab comes to the farm, takes half of their harvest. So now there's not enough to live.
The government of Somalia controls not all of the country, and that makes getting food and aid and assistance to the people who need it most is almost impossible. So where we are in Baidoa, you can only fly in humanitarian aid. You can't drive it in because the roads are controlled by al-Shabaab. So that complicates things even more.
Just devastating scenes in this footage that you've been sending back. All right, Matt Gutman, they're on the ground in Somalia. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Brad.
All right, one more quick break. When we come back, British officials are now saying, please, whatever you do, no more teddy bears. One last thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. We talked about how intense the mourning has been over the late Queen Elizabeth, but it's gotten to the point where Buckingham Palace should come with a tag. Please look after all these bears. Yesterday, the Royal Park Service, which oversees the grounds near Buckingham Palace, put out an official statement begging people to stop laying teddy bears outside the gates because there were just too many Paddingtons.
Well, I hope I don't look weird after all that.
The adorable bear, which the story goes, hails from Peru, has become almost synonymous with the Queen since her Platinum Jubilee, when she sat down with a CGI Paddington in a video sketch.
Perhaps you would like a marmalade sandwich. I always keep one for emergencies.
So do I.
And what was so delightful about that sketch was it both seemed to capture the Queen, this regal woman, not afraid to get a little bit silly, and it captured how her own nation felt about her.
Thank you. For everything.
But that's led to too many Paddingtons, as well as too many people leaving marmalade sandwiches outside. People are just putting them next to the bear. Not only do officials not want food rotting outside the palace, but the new king, Charles, is famously devoted to sustainability.
Planet's health today will dictate the health, happiness, and the economic prosperity of generations to come.
So, the word from parks officials is no plastic bags, no teddy bears, and if you bring flowers, they ask they not be wrapped in plastic. Eventually, the palace says, the remaining flowers will be composted. Candles are not allowed for safety concerns. They do say cards are welcome, though to keep people's well wishes from piling up too high, they'll be removing them discreetly day by day. In the meantime, among the bouquets, I have a feeling every now and then, there might still be a very rare sort of bear. I'm genuinely curious to know what it's about to smell like 7 days after the funeral. That is how long Royal Park says that all these floral tributes will remain in place. A lot more coverage, other royal proceedings in the UK today. Check out abcnews.com or the ABC News app for up-to-the-minute coverage. I'm Brad Milkey. See you tomorrow.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.